recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would like to turn the call over to Dr. Diana Hadjibegovic. You may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Today's COCA conference call is about quarantine. I'm glad to introduce Danica Tomjanovic. She has been working with the CDC and CID Division of Global Migration and Quarantine, Quarantine and Border Health Services Branch at the Miami Quarantine Station as a Quarantine Public Health Officer for approximately 3 years. In 1998, she held an internship position at the World Health Organization Mental Health Program in Geneva, Switzerland, developing a community-based mental health care program for displaced persons in Rwanda and ex-Yugoslavia. She also has epidemiological research experience in rural health care issues in Costa Rica. More recently, Danica has had experience in Hurricane Katrina disaster relief efforts relating to infection control and outbreak containment. On the end of this call, listener can have knowledge, basic knowledge of quarantine definitions, history, legal basis and authority, functions of U.S. quarantine stations, principles of modern quarantines as containment measure. I would like to emphasize that these calls are for clinicians, and we would like to remind any members of the media that hold their questions on the end for the end of this call, questions and answer session, and they can call media relations at 404-639-3286. Thank you for this. Danica, you may start, please.
Great. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for having me today to speak about quarantine. So over the next hour, you'll be seeing my slides on your screen, so I'll be going through those slides, and once I'm finished with one, I would say next, and you can just proceed to the next one. So we're on the objective slide, and over the next half an hour, I'm going to go over the basics of quarantine, including its definitions, history, and its legal basis and authority. I'm going to also go over who we are, who the quarantine public health program is, our current functions at quarantine stations, and finally review the principles of modern quarantine. I wanted to end with a question and answer session demonstrating some of the principles of quarantine using SARS as an example, and we'll lead to that towards the end of the talk. Next slide. When thinking about quarantine, pictures like this may come to mind. This is during the Spanish flu in 1918, the last time that widespread quarantine was implemented in the United States. Since then, the principles of quarantine have evolved, and I hope to demonstrate that in today's talk. Next slide. So let me begin with the basics. Quarantine is defined as the separation and restriction of movement of well persons presumed to have been exposed to a contagion. So these persons are the contacts of cases with an illness and are asymptomatic. Quarantine can be done at home or in a residential facility and may be voluntary or mandatory. Next slide. The term isolation, on the other hand, refers to the separation and restricted movement of ill persons with a contagious disease. So this applies to the cases, and these are people who are symptomatic. Isolation is commonly done in a hospital setting, primarily at an individual level, or may be applied to a population. Often is voluntary, but may be mandatory. And isolation is commonly used as a public health practice in hospitals, for example, as done in hospitals every day in management of TB cases. Both of these terms are applied with a common goal of disease containment. Next slide. So over the next few slides, I want to review some of the history of quarantine, which is very rich and interesting. Firstly, historically, the concept and mission of quarantine has always been to prevent the importation and spread of diseases and protect populations from contagious diseases. The root of quarantine goes way back to the Old Testament, where there's a description of the practice of isolating persons afflicted with leprosy. In the 14th century Europe, the plague epidemic, or Black Death, moved across Europe, prompting Venice to impose a mandatory 40-day harbor detention for ships landing into its port. The term quarantine is actually derived from the Latin quarantigena, which is a period of 40 days, which was believed to be a disease to be contagious. Venice's example was followed by other European city-states, and the first quarantine station was established in 1626 in Marseille, France, which also introduced the first bill of health. This certified incoming ships to be healthy and disease-free. In the 1700s, vessels en route to England were required to show a solid yellow flag to indicate that they were under quarantine, and this became known as the quarantine flag. And actually, this flag is still worn on the quarantine officers' uniforms today. Next slide. Quarantine in the United States, however, initially was handled as a local matter by individual colonies. The earliest evidence of quarantine in the United States was in Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1647. Due to a plague in West Indies, ships from this region were banned to land there. Later in 1798, for example, the governor of Pennsylvania declared a cordon sanitaire around Philadelphia in response to an outbreak of yellow fever. This extreme action, which included isolating the federal government, which was sitting in Philadelphia at the time, was generally considered to be an appropriate action to the threat of yellow fever. Unhealthy or sickly vessels were not to come closer than 1 mile from land without a certified bill of health. The shift of quarantine powers from the state to the federal government began in 1878 with the passing of the National Quarantine Act, but it was really with the passing of the Public Health Service Act in 1944 that defined the current role of the federal government in quarantine, and I will describe this in more detail in a moment. Next slide. Now let me talk about the legalities of quarantine. Today, currently, the states are primarily responsible for the exercise of public health powers to control outbreaks within their states. The quarantine is considered a police power as an inherent authority to protect the health and welfare of its citizens that is reserved to the states by the 10th Amendment. States, therefore, have the primary responsibility for quarantine within their own borders. Next slide. However, the federal government has the primary responsibility for quarantine of persons arriving from foreign countries and for interstate or state-to-state quarantine. This is not only to protect the health of the people, but also to protect commerce, and therefore it derives its authority from the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. So when there is a risk of transmission of an infectious disease occurring across state lines, the federal government has authority to enact quarantine with the decision of the President of the United States. The CDC is a federal agency authorized to implement federal quarantine, and the specific functions are carried out by the Division of Global Migration and Quarantine. The CDC may intervene in intrastate incidents and apply a variety of disease containment measures if the help is requested from the state or if an event of inadequate local control. Next slide. So our division's functions are outlined in Title 42, Code of Federal Regulations, Part 71, Foreign Quarantine Regulations. This regulation mandates that the master of a ship destined for a U.S. port or a commander of an aircraft destined for a U.S. airport shall report immediately to the quarantine station at or nearest the port at which the ship or aircraft will arrive any occurrence on board of any death or any ill person among passengers or crew. And an ill person is defined in this regulation as it reads here on this bullet, is someone who has a fever persisting for 48 hours or more and has rash or glandular swelling or jaundice or has diarrhea with or without fever. Also in this regulation, persons arriving into the United States may be quarantined or placed under medical surveillance. Individuals placed under medical surveillance must provide information about their health and intended destination and report for medical examinations as may be required. This regulation also authorizes a variety of sanitary measures over carriers, articles, and cargo destined for entry into the United States. For example, our program performs rat inspections on maritime vessels, and we issue deratting certificates stating that the ship is free of rats as a vector of disease. The power of quarantine, however, is limited to 9 quarantinable diseases listed on the executive order signed by the President of the United States. Next slide. And here are those diseases. This is the executive order, which lists the 9 diseases for which quarantine can be enforced. So currently there are 9 of these, including cholera, diphtheria, infectious TB, plague, smallpox, yellow fever, and viral hemorrhagic fevers. And newly additions are SARS and influenza caused by novel or reemergent influenza viruses that are causing or have the potential to cause a pandemic. Next slide. Now, the federal authority also has regulations, which is 42 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 70, requiring interstate conveyance operators to report communicable diseases to local health authorities rather than the federal quarantine stations. So these regulations also authorize states to implement quarantine through a federal travel permit system. Under these regulations, persons in the communicable stage of a certain communicable disease may not board a conveyance or travel interstate without first obtaining a written permit from the Surgeon General or designee. This regulation also authorizes CDC to intervene with intrastate and apply a variety of disease containment measures in the event of inadequate local control. Next slide. So let me now refer back to the Public Health Service Act signed in 1944 that I mentioned earlier. With it, Congress clearly stated that quarantine authority of the federal government for the first time, and it is the basis for the current federal quarantine authority. This act created an extension of the Maritime Health Services, which is the forerunner of the modern U.S. Public Health Services, and it outlined major responsibilities of the U.S. Quarantine Service, which are now under the jurisdiction of the Division of Global Migration and Quarantine. The three major responsibilities that were outlined were, first, the treatment of ill seamen or those without land-based homes, for example, Navy men, were able now to have free public health services. Secondly, there was the health screening of arriving immigrants was under the U.S. Public Health Services. The responsibility fell under the United States Public Health Services. And thirdly, the assessment of illnesses aboard arriving vessels was also under the jurisdiction of U.S. Public Health Services. And this is done at quarantine stations by quarantine officers on aircraft and vessels during the CDC SARS response. Next slide. So this brings me to how the current quarantine program has evolved since then. In the 1960s, the quarantine program was at its peak. Public health officers would be the first and the only person to board all arriving international aircraft and visually observe each passenger and crew member for signs of illness. Next slide. However, in the 1970s, with the eradication of smallpox, there was less fear of infectious diseases, so smaller stations closed, but the officers continued to oversee refugee screening. In the 1980s, stations were involved in mass migration emergencies as they occurred, and health information for international travelers was needed and given, and distribution of emergency immunobiologics began, for example, antitoxin for diphtheria and botulism. In the 1990s, old infectious diseases resurged. The quarantine program responded to the reappearance of cholera in South America in 91, pneumonic plague in India in 94, and Ebola in Zaire in 1995, and of course continue to process arriving refugees. Next slide. By 2004, the U.S. quarantine program was a mere skeleton of what it was under the Department of Health and Welfare, which is the forerunner to the Department of Health and Human Services. In 1953, it was present in 52 seaports, 41 airports, and had 600 employees. But the responsibility of our mission has not diminished, and in fact, it has grown greater in light of recent world health events. Next slide. The potential for transmission of infectious diseases has grown greater and become a public health challenge for one reason due to global migration patterns. This shows the major migration flow patterns between 1960 and 75. Next slide. While this is the migration flow in 1990s, during which global migration has increased by fourfold, since the 60s and 70s, and therefore challenges continue to grow for public health. Next slide. Not to mention novel and newly emerging infectious diseases such as SARS. Next slide. These activities have prompted the revival of the U.S. quarantine program such that in 1 year we have grown from 18 stations to 25. And currently, if you look at this map, where the stars are located is where all the current quarantine stations are. Next slide. Currently, the U.S. quarantine program is part of the Department of Health and Human Services with the Center for Disease Control. Within CDC, it is part of the National Center for Infectious Diseases and the Division of Global Migration and Quarantine and the Quarantine and Border Health Branch. Next slide. Our mission is really simple. We exist to protect the health of the public from imported communicable diseases. However, the challenge is in accomplishing this. We can only accomplish this through our partnerships and cooperation with other federal agencies, such as Customs and Border Protection, U.S. Coast Guard, airlines, local hospitals, local and state health departments as well. Next slide. So now let me go into the specific functions that our quarantine stations have. We respond to reports of illnesses on maritime vessels, cruise and cargo, and airplanes. We are involved in emergency planning and preparedness. We inspect animal and human products that may pose a threat to human health. We monitor health and collect and distribute and manage medical information of newly arriving immigrants, refugees, and parolees. Next slide. We also perform inspections of cargo and hand-carried items. We distribute immunobiologics and investigational drugs, like I said before, anti-diphtheria and anti-botulism. We provide travelers with essential health information, and we respond to mass migration emergencies. Next slide. Quarantine, however, is still viewed as a dirty word by most due to a portion of its history depicted in this photo. Between 1870 and 1920, a wave of poor immigrants from Eastern Europe were driven out of their countries into the United States on crowded ships and bringing with them many infectious diseases. Once they were in the United States, they were stigmatized by the rich Western Europeans who had migrated earlier in the 1800s. So quarantine became more of a political tool to exclude people based on wealth and ethnicity. This history has shaped principles of modern quarantine and highlighted that quarantine should be based on scientific and public health principles, paying respect to civil liberties and rights. Next slide. Therefore, as depicted here visually, the goal of modern quarantine principles is to obtain a fine balance between public good and civil liberties. Next slide. So what is the purpose of quarantine in today's times? Well, quarantine falls under a range of community containment strategies. It is not to be used alone. It is applied to persons exposed but not ill, and it is designed to meet two objectives: facilitate early recognition of symptoms of a contagious disease, and thereby reduce the risk of transmission before progression to that disease. Next slide. I've already talked about legalities, but it's important to remember that although the federal government and states have the legal authority to implement quarantine, it should never become policy indiscriminately. Quarantine is an important tool, but is not a substitute for other tools such as resources, planning, and communication. Next slide. So there are three main questions to ask before implementing quarantine. The first one, is there public health and medical justification? You want to consider the infectious agent and the communicability and the risk of fatality. Quarantine should not be implemented longer than an incubation period. If it's a disease with a long incubation period, could people really be quarantined for such a long period of time and are resources available to do so? For example, hepatitis A, which is an illness that you would not use quarantine for, but the incubation period is approximately 28 days, and a person is communicable before the onset of symptoms. So what would be the value in quarantine? And the reported case fatality for Hep A is normally low. The second question to ask before you implement quarantine is, are implementation and maintenance of quarantine feasible? You want to define who is to be quarantined and for how long, and can one sustain the resources for that time? So again, going to Hep A, for example, the incubation period of 28 days, can you really sustain quarantine for that long? Can you provide food, water, health care, mental health, and communication for those persons for that period of time? And the third question to ask is, do the potential benefits of quarantine outweigh the adverse consequences? You want to consider the health risks of those quarantines and consequences of disobedience, and even their effect on commerce. Of course, the longer the period of quarantine, the greater the effect on commerce, stopping free flow of people, etc. So again, these are the key questions to ask before you decide to implement quarantine. Next question. Next slide. Okay, now I want to go over and summarize 10 principles of community containment. Remember, quarantine is a tool of containment and not the only form. The first principle is that containment measures are appropriate when a person or group of people have been exposed to a highly dangerous and contagious disease, exposed well persons are separated from ill cases, and resources are available to implement and support those interventions, which include providing essential goods, monitoring health, and providing medical care if necessary. Next slide. The second principle is there are a wide range of measures that can be used as community containment measures, for example, snow days, closure of public events, restricting non-essential travel, and cordon sanitaire, which is the most severe method, whereby there's an imaginary perimeter basically that's established and there's no movement in and out of that area. Next slide. The third principle is that containment measures should be used in combination with other interventions, such as enhanced surveillance and symptom monitoring, rapid diagnosis and treatment for those who become ill, and administering of vaccinations and prophylactic antibiotics should continue to be done as public health measures. Next slide. Fourth principle is that quarantined persons must be among the first to receive all available disease-preventing interventions, vaccination, antibiotics, early treatment if symptoms appear. Next slide. The fifth principle is that modern quarantine should last only as long as necessary to ensure that quarantined persons do not become ill. Maximum quarantine is related to the incubation period, as I mentioned before. And a person has the right to due process. This is ensuring that there is no abuse in the quarantine like there once was. Next slide. The sixth principle is that modern quarantine does not have to be absolute to be effective. Partial or leaky quarantine is affected. For example, during SARS, there were two levels of quarantine that were implemented. Level A for those that were close contacts, healthcare providers for persons that had SARS, and the level B who were for people that traveled from endemic areas but not necessarily had close contacts. Next slide. In an outbreak setting, community containment measures initially applies to small focus settings. For example, where the threat occurred, such as on a plane, we may only quarantine those in certain rows and not the whole plane to the person that had an infectious disease, or if something happened in a theater where there's an intentional release of a public health threat. You may only implement quarantine or community containment measures in those initial close settings. Next slide. The eighth principle is that implementation of containment measures requires a clear understanding of legal authority at each level, and that community containment measures should not be done by a single agency, but it requires cooperation between states, local, and federal partners. Next slide. The ninth principle is, again, that implementation of community containment requires coordinated planning by many partners, public health practitioners, healthcare facilities, and even those entities that are not usually thought of in public health, such as transportation authorities and law enforcement. Next slide. The last principle is that in order to achieve trust and cooperation, the public must receive a clear communication of the infectious illness, the justification of the community containment measure, and the duration and endpoints of those measures. This principle really captures the focus of civil liberties in implementing a community containment measure. Next slide. So at the end of quarantine, when you want to really evaluate the effectiveness of quarantine, there are three important questions to ask. Was quarantine applied to the appropriate population? Did use of quarantine limit the progression of the outbreak? And was the implementation of quarantine humane? Next slide. So now I want to review some community containment measures using SARS as an example. As some background information, SARS affected 29 countries, and there are approximately 8,400 cases and 800 deaths. The most affected countries were China, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Canada. The United States largely escaped the epidemic, where between March and July 2003, approximately 400 persons met the case definition of suspected or probable, but only 8 were lab confirmed. Between those dates, the quarantine stations visually inspected and distributed health information to 2.7 million people on approximately 11,000 international flights in collaboration with Customs and Border Protection. Next slide. So I wanted to go over some elements of community containment measures that I just discussed. And again, I'm using SARS as an example to do this. So during SARS, some of the elements that were used were case management, contact management, hospital and facility infection control, and community containment, such as quarantine. Border response was also a measure that was used, and I'll go and talk about that in just a moment. Next slide. So what are some of the deciding factors for the levels of containment response? You want to consider the severity and extent of a response can really vary from basic to enhanced, depending on the magnitude and scope of an outbreak, the pattern of transmission, the resources available for the response, and the community cooperation and trust. In the United States, for the most part, we had a basic response because there was no evidence of person-to-person transmission and no real outbreak situation. However, in China, Hong Kong, In Canada and others, there was more of an enhanced response to SARS. Next slide. The correct term for separation of cases, again, these are the cases, is isolation. And some of the basic methods of isolation is home isolation, if it provides adequate care and infection control measures, and hospital isolation if medically necessary. Next slide. A possible enhanced method of isolation is community-based facility isolation, where, again, patient care and infection control requirements must be adequate. And in Taiwan and China, for example, they built hospitals and hospital facilities just for SARS cases. Next slide. The correct term for separation of those who are contacts is quarantine. And this is not a basic activity, and it was not done in the United States during SARS. But during SARS, United States recommended individuals who travel from endemic areas to monitor their health for 10 days without activity restrictions. And this information was provided to the travelers with health alert notices that were distributed at international ports of entry. Next slide. Some of the enhanced activities of contacts that were implemented in Canada and Asia, for example, were home quarantine, working quarantine, facility-based quarantine. And some of the things that were monitored daily under those in quarantine were clinical symptoms, fever and respiratory symptoms specifically for this case. And the duration of quarantine was for the incubation period, 10 days, although at first, because it was not well known how long the incubation period was, the quarantine was implemented for 14 days and then later scaled down to 10 days. And the resources needed to be provided were basic necessities such as food, health care, mental health, and communication. Next slide. So some of the basic community containment measures utilized around the world included providing public information and education and promoting respiratory hygiene and hand washing. Some of the enhanced activities implemented in Canada and Asia were cordon sanitaire, widespread community quarantine, and more measures to increase social distance. So next slide. So what are some of the ways to increase social distance to implement methods like snow days? You want to close schools, cancel public gatherings, minimize exposure to others by closing markets or public transit. Some other methods include the distribution of surgical masks and temperature screenings done at airports. Next slide. Some basic border and travel responses were to develop and issue travel advisories. We crafted and posted website guidance documents, the distribution of health alert notices and visually inspecting passengers arriving from SARS-affected areas, responding to ill passengers, and these were some of the activities that were done by the quarantine stations. Some of the enhanced activities that were done in Canada and in Asia included pre-departure and arrival screening, quarantine of travelers from SARS areas, and restrictions of non-essential travel. So, next slide. In summary, there are clear messages about need for quarantine really increase the public acceptance, and we learned this during SARS. Quarantine can be voluntary, mental health support is essential, and the implementation of large-scale quarantine is complex and resource-intensive. Next slide. So I'd like to acknowledge the Division of Global Migration and Quarantine and the CDC Miami Quarantine Station staff for allowing me to present today. Next slide. Are there any questions?
Mr. Mianowicz, thank you very much for this presentation. It was a great presentation. And also, for those of you who didn't have a chance to ask questions, please email us on coca@cdc.gov with your questions, and we will certainly respond to your questions. Let me remind you on instant replay, toll-free number, if you want to listen again this presentation, the number is 866-383-2967. Also, recording will be available as downloadable audio file on our COCA website, www.bt.cdc.gov/COCA. Thank you very much one more time, and stay tuned for our next COCA conference call. Goodbye.